Thank you very much, Rusty. Thank you to Catholic University and the Institute for, what is it called? Human Ecology. No, and Joe Capizzi, who ably runs the Institute. Actually, let me, I think Rusty will pay me anyway for tonight, but let me say just a word and invite you. I think First Things has always been and has certainly become a voice, a singular voice of reflection, I think a point of focus for so many of the conversations that are necessary but have so few venues in our polity today. And I know from having organized a lot of these kinds of events in the past that you do this with enormous energy and effort, and yet at the end, it's the person you invite that gets the applause. So before I begin, I invite you to join me in thanking the work of First Things for all that they do tonight. Well, it's nice to be back in Washington, D.C. in this warm weather. I appreciate the invitation to come at this balmy time of year, and I mean it. Tonight I want to talk about the aristocrats and the populists and this odd idea of aristopopulism. In the long history of political thought in the West, it's a striking fact that until very recent times, most words used to describe the upper class had very positive connotations, while those used to describe the people generally carried negative overtones. Think, for example, of the word aristocracy, a word meaning in the ancient Greek rule by aristoi, not just the few, but the excellent or the best people of distinctively good quality. Or consider the word patrician, derived from the word father, pater, a connection so positive that a version of this word, Patrick, was the given name of the patron saint of Ireland, and of course so many very fine individuals since then. Or the word dignity, the root word for our word dignitaries, people of worth, distinction, character. In a similar vein, consider the word nobility, derived from the Latin nobilis, and used widely throughout Europe to describe the upper classes, meaning not only high-born, but as today, something noble, which then and now means excellent, having dignity, grace, greatness, and distinguished from that which is base or common or ordinary. Many of the words that we still today use to distinguish fine from base, superior to inferior, excellent from subpar, draw on this long-standing and implicit set of high expectations and praise for those in positions of leadership and distinction in earlier societies. By contrast, the words used to describe the people have more typically derogatory and are critical in their connotations. After all, common is a word used to describe ordinary or not distinguished and contrary to something that's excellent. Other words used to describe the commoners have been plebeians or plebes, the mob, or its Greek origin, or its Greek original word oklos, for ochlocracy, rule by the mob. Peasant, multitude, crowd, mass. Even the somewhat neutral term that I've been using, the people, shares a common root with the word on everyone's lips today, populism, from the Latin populus, a word with generally negative connotations then as now. These respective positive and negative significations are most obviously rooted in a different set of assumptions about human ranking and status, based in an age that designated people according to station, mostly as a result of birth and inheritance. These designations reflect, among other things, the superseded beliefs of an aristocratic age that Tocqueville would describe in certain ways as more likely to promote certain forms of human excellence, but ultimately one that was less just and therefore ultimately indefensible. However, at the same time, these positive connotations denoting certain humans for their excellence and their nobility made other implicit claims, ones that were not inherently a condemnation of equality, but an aspirational call to an equality of shared excellence. Among Tocqueville's greatest worries about democracy was its tendency to define equality down, seeking to make all people equal through the headlong pursuit of a debased standard, the kind of condition or situation described with comic brilliance in Kurt Vonnegut's short story, Harrison Bergeron. For those who know it, you know what I'm speaking of. If you don't, read it. Tocqueville hoped and commended that democracy might aspire to an equality based upon higher standards of human excellence, nobility, majesty, and virtue, ones that could be shared widely. He hoped that even in ages of equality, there would remain a strata within a democratic society that would take on the task of practicing what the aristocrats of old too often only preached, a form of noblesse oblige. He believed it would be especially the professional classes that would fill the role and place of the aristocrats of old, the lawyers, the bankers, the doctors, the preachers, and that they would have a special obligation, and he hoped they would take on this obligation to inspire their countrymen to a high standard of excellence and nobility. Indeed, there's a chapter of Democracy in America that never fails to startle and amuse my students, in which he reserves special praise and hope for the role of lawyers in a democracy as a kind of tutor of a kind of excellence, teachers not only of the law, but of virtues that would be necessary in a democracy, of law-abidingness, of a respect for authority, of the values of stability amid the tumultuous inclinations of democratic ages, and a certain deference to the wisdom of tradition embodied in the common law. And observing the lawyers and the professionals of his time, of that time when Tocqueville traveled in America, it's not surprising that he might have had this confidence in their example. Exemplifying just such a commitment toward an equality of excellence, John Adams, some decades earlier, would write with assurance of the essential need for those with privilege and advantage to elevate the less fortunate fellow countrymen, writing in his Thoughts on Government, quote, "Laws for liberal education of youth, especially the lower class of people, are so extremely wise and useful that to a humane and generous mind, no expense for this purpose would be thought extravagant." What is striking today is the reversal of this long-standing set of positive and negative associations that distinguish the high from the low. The word people can't be said often enough by our political class today, invoked regularly by our political leaders to lend legitimacy to their statements, embodied by that almost mystical incantation and phrase, "the American people believe or think or want," etc. The word democracy is everywhere embraced as the gold standard for political legitimacy today, in sharp contrast to the long-standing view throughout the Western tradition, which ranked democracy as among the worst of all forms of government. And this belief continued until fairly recent times, including the views of our founding fathers, who explicitly argued that they were founding not a democracy, but rather a republic. Of course, not only the word democracy has seen a dramatic reversal in its fortunes, but we have witnessed a corresponding rise of negative connotations for any word denoting or demarking the upper classes. Almost no one today, except for maybe Edward Habsburg on Twitter, would claim the designation of being an aristocrat, a member of the nobility, or a patrician. Dignity is a word that retains appeal, but only in as much as everyone possesses it as a matter of right. What's even more striking is that we do not have a positive word to describe someone of today's upper class. There is no positive word used by members of our upper class to describe themselves. Indeed, it is frequently observed that no matter one's status and position in American society today, all claim to be members and part of the middle class. One word that is regularly used today to describe such people is elites, but it's not a word used by the members of the elite themselves to describe themselves, but rather as an implicit critique and denunciation. Rather, most of today's elites, and I guess I have to use this word, readily embrace both the labels of egalitarianism and considerable energy is exercised by their most vocal leaders to root out any vestiges of privilege or elitism. This leads to not infrequent and amusing denunciations of inequality from the most elevated perches of the land. For some years while I taught at Princeton University, I had taped to my office door an article about the exclusivity and the elite status of some of Princeton's eating clubs. I highlighted in yellow marker a quotation from the dean of students at Princeton, speaking of the presence of these selective institutions, which read, and I quote, "There is no place for elitism on the Princeton campus." I didn't get tenure at Princeton. We find ourselves in a curious place in the history of regimes. The elites of modern Western society have uniformly embraced the self-description of being exemplars of egalitarianism and a vocal force against elitism and privilege. Yet their greatest animus is no longer against the aristocrats of old, since most of the vestiges of the old aristocratic order have been dismantled, but marshaled today extensively against the greatest perceived source of inegalitarianism in today's world, namely the people, specifically the rise of populist movements in the United States and England and throughout Europe. One can easily imagine future historians relating and marveling at the extraordinary tactic of the 21st century elite, no longer seeking, as in times past, to justify their position by appeal to ideals such as being aristoi or nobility or patricians, but by claiming the mantle of egalitarian opposition to privilege found in the masses and characterized above all by distinguishing true democracy from populism. This form of politics at once masks but also reveals in a new form what is an age-old contestation between mass and elite, in which the elite is generally advantaged by power and wealth, but from time to time is called either by some of its own or forced by the populace to act with nobility toward the less fortunate. The elite today, instead, veil their status, even and especially to themselves, through efforts to root out privilege, engaging in a kind of stupendous effort of self-deception about the nature of their own position. Tonight, I want to argue that there is this veiling of the elite with this guise of egalitarianism, which not only serves as a kind of mask of self-deception, but even a form of class warfare, a means of solidifying advantages of and position of today's elite. As our economy and our social lives have increasingly become zero-sum games, made that way increasingly by those who write the rules, the elites have increasingly designed ways of life that buffer them from the devastating effects of the world they have created upon the lives of their fellow countrymen. The deteriorating economic prospects and social conditions of a sizable number of their fellow citizens is a consequence of this kind of warfare, and the evident unassailability of this self-deception as both a weapon and a shield means that we cannot expect today's elite to surrender their advantages in the name of some newfound noblesse oblige. In such a condition, the foreseeable future that I think many of us have prepared ourselves for is one in which the mass and elite remain locked in a prolonged adversarial contest. Most of us have settled in for this prospect, arrayed, if not expecting complete victory by one side or the other, and in the meantime willing to scorch the earth in the hopes that one side is deprived of advantage. Scores of books are now appearing, either denouncing populism or elitism, marshaling arguments for one side that prepares the intellectual shock troops for yet another attack over the ramparts. But if we are indeed locked in a battle, not between self-described opponents of privileges, but between, in some ways, those classical regimes that pitted oligarchs against the masses, then some ancient wisdom on this question is called for. In particular, we are summoned to recall the ancient lessons about the likely outcome of such a pitched battle, either tyranny by one or the other, or anarchy, or at worst, both. And we should seek its avoidance by recalling the ancient commendations of mixed government, with its prospects of elevating each side, and in blessed and extraordinary circumstances, achieving a different kind of condition in which the polity as a whole achieves a common good. But if there is to be a challenge to what the classical philosophers would have recognized as the natural advantages of an oligarchy, today it will have to come from the insistent demands of the populace. In yet a further reversal of traditional roles, it will be only through the aggressive and sustained battle by the populists that the elite might in fact begin to act with nobility, and in so doing might take on that Tocquevillian task of in turn ennobling the people. Now, while we have largely come to understand this divide as comprehensible through the lens of left versus right, red versus blue, Democrat versus Republican, the broad categorization of today's divide as taking place within the regime of democracy obscures that we are witnessing the reassertion of a very ancient phenomenon, one that caused all political thinkers of the classical era to fret about the prospects for political justice, for civic peace, and yes, for the longevity of any regime. Nearly to a man, and yes, they were all men, authors ranging from Aristotle and Aquinas, from Cicero to Polybius, from Machiavelli to Montesquieu, all observed that the most fundamental division of any regime was eternally between the few and the many, and with the main source of this distinction being between the being the contest between the wealthy few and the power of numbers possessed by the many. Aristotle stated that every regime was divided between the interests of the many poor, the party of democracy, and the few wealthy, the party of oligarchy. And similarly, centuries later, Machiavelli observed that the two great parties in any regime are composed of what he called the nobili and the populi, the nobles and the populace, or the aristocrats and the people. Both, and indeed all the thinkers I have mentioned, believed that it was the natural course of any regime ultimately either to be torn apart by this division, or for one party to rule tyrannically over the other, unless, either through remarkable political art or through some kind of miraculous chance, a form of balance and even mutual benefit might be achieved. There was substantial agreement among these thinkers that regimes were likely to devolve into forms of cold or hot civil war because of this divide. And because of this, these thinkers saw a solution to the problem of internal stasis. On one side of this debate among the ancients, Aristotle and his best student, St. Thomas Aquinas, both believed that the best avenue to resolving this internal tension was through the creation of a mixed regime aimed at fostering the common good. Aristotle, in particular, who I'll focus on, much to the disappointment of the Dominicans in the audience, argued on behalf of the most realistic of the best regimes, one he called polity, which was the generic word for regime. And he argued that polity was the combination of two of the worst regimes, oligarchy and democracy, the party of the few and the party of the many. He argued that such a combination was not simply a kind of stew that would leave the distinct elements visible and remaining, but rather, to use a phrase known to many of us, a kind of melting pot in which the two elements eventually blended so much together that the city ceased to be composed of two parties, but instead became unitary. This was to be achieved, he believed, through a kind of mixing of the elements through politics as well as sort of social forms. So he gives the example of paying everyone for public service, for example, still continued in some ways in that massive check you get if you serve in jury duty, as well as, of course, generalized and social economic similarity. Aristotle was especially insistent on fostering a large middling element, he called it, people who were no longer poor or wealthy, not easily identified with belonging to either the party of the oligarchs or the Democrats. Further, he thought in such a condition, a kind of friendship would arise between those elements in the society that were still somewhat divided, in which he said the outcome, the ideal outcome, would be a condition in which the more oligarchic strata would consider political matters from the perspective of Democrats and vice versa. Now, by contrast, Machiavelli, who was always characteristically hostile to the ancients and to the scholastics, while agreeing that society was divided between these two classes, believed that this battle was inevitable and unavoidable. He held the view that it was the very dissensus and class and clash between the two classes, the elite and the populace, that had provided for the conditions of liberty that in turn fueled Rome's rise from a republican city-state to a world-straddling empire. Machiavelli excoriated critics explicitly from time to time, Aristotle and Aquinas and those who read him, for their disapproval of the discord and division that was a characteristic feature of Roman political life. In fact, he viewed such discord as a sign of Rome's political health, and in particular, evidence of a vital resistance among the populace to the greater ability of the nobility to suppress the popular party. Notice where the resistance lay back in those days. Machiavelli dismissed the attacks by the Aristotelians of his day, who, to quote him, criticized the clashes between the nobility and the populace, which in his view was, quoting again, the primary factor making for Rome's continuing freedom. This form of discord was evidence of a vitality, particularly from the populace, to gain concessions from the elites, that not only ended resisting oppression and protecting the freedom of the populace, but ultimately protecting Roman freedom itself and extending Roman power as a whole. In a description in which he describes this capacity of the populace to gain concessions, and which I think was written in part for comic effect, he describes some of these forms of resistance as follows, and I quote, "If someone were to argue that the methods employed by the populace were extra-legal and bestial, the people in a mob shouting abuse at the Senate replying in kind, mobs running through the streets, shops boarded up, the entire populace of Washington, D.C., Rome leaving the city, I would reply that such things frighten only those who read about them." I mean, who would be afraid if the entire capital city were empty because of the rise of the populace? Maybe they know what he's speaking of in Paris today. Machiavelli goes on to point out that concessions that the people were able to extract from the elite were achieved either through demonstration or by refusing to serve in the military, and concludes, and I quote, "The demands of a free people are rarely harmful to the cause of liberty, for they are a response either to oppression or to the prospects of oppression." In his view, only a permanent and relatively balanced set of counteracting forces could preserve the vitality of this form of new republicanism, in contrast to the ancient republicanism recommended by Aristotle and by St. Aquinas that viewed broad equality, unity, concord, and virtue as a main aim and end of politics. Now, America's founding fathers were more attracted to the modern teachings of Machiavelli, explicitly rejecting the vision of common good based in virtue and a shared common good that lay at the heart of the ancient teaching, but they introduced some important modifications. While many of today's admirers of our Constitution see it as continuous in the tradition of the mixed regime, of mixed government, and point especially to the theory that you all learned in high school, the separation of powers and checks and balances, as evidence of the Constitution's adoption of this classical teaching, in fact, these elements of the Constitution were specifically designed and intended to restrain the elite from acting tyrannically, and not as such to empower the people. The Federalist Papers are divided into two broad parts, two halves, addressing the two tasks that Madison set out in Federalist 51. Quote, "In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, The great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place oblige it to control itself. The main strategies of this first aim, enabling the government to control the governed, was addressed mainly in the first part of the Federalist Papers and especially articulated in Federalist 10. The aim of the Constitution in regards to the populace specifically was to filter the views of the public through representatives who would be fit characters and through the expansion of the geographic scale of politics to enlarge the orbit and thus to dissipate the potential energy of popular force and power by the challenge presented of mustering majorities in such a large and diverse nation, of the fact of shifting coalitions that would foster a certain degree of mistrust among the people toward one another, and a general frustration with the inability to greatly influence public life that would lead to a greater interest in private rather than public life. By contrast, the more Machiavellian part of the Federalist Papers, which calls for ambition to counteract ambition, appears in the latter part of the Federalist Papers, particularly concerning how elected leaders could be prevented from colluding with each other on elevation to elected office. Now, whatever the expected efficacy of this arrangement, it has in fact been long superseded by the effective evisceration of the separation of powers with the self-imposed weakening of the legislative branch, the rise and growth of a permanent bureaucracy, and the role of money and wealth as a basic requirement for winning and retaining political office. What was then an already a political order arranged to encourage the emergence of a political and economic elite class while suppressing the political energy of the populace has been pumped up with the steroids of concentrated economic and political power. We're living now in a time in which we are seeing the realization of this growing divide. We live through a time in which we had relative peace between the classes, and it particularly is well described by Yuval Levin in his book, The Fractured Republic, the time of the 1950s and the post-World War II era, which both the left and the right looks back to today as a time of relative equality, civil peace, respect for religious institutions, stability, and norms. But since the unraveling of these unique conditions of the post-World War II period of this relative economic equality and a broad devotion to certain norms of life, a growing and now gaping divide separates those who benefit from the American regime from those who struggle at its edges. At the time of the early 1990s, the late historian Christopher Lash contrasted the two cultures of the lower middle class and the elites. And he contrasted them in the following way. The lower middle class culture, he wrote, is organized around family, church, and neighborhood. It values the community's continuity more than individual advancement and solidarity more than social mobility. Conventional ideas of success play a less important role in lower middle class life than the maintenance of existing ways. Parents want their children to get ahead, but they also want them to respect their elders, resist the temptation to lie and cheat, willingly shoulder the responsibilities that fall to them, and bear adversity with fortitude. More concerned with honor than with worldly ambition, they have less interest in the future than do upper middle class parents who try to equip their children with the qualities required for competitive advantage. By contrast, he described the new elite, the meritocracy, and contrasted this new meritocracy to the old aristocracy as having retained many of the vices of aristocracy without its virtues. Their prized mobility, he wrote, leads them to recognize few obligations to the communities that they profess to lead. Their oft-stated commitments to the poor and disadvantaged is depersonalized, exercised through the agency of the state, the burden falling not on the professional and managerial class, but disproportionately on the lower middle and working class. Their real view toward the less advantaged, Lash wrote, is one of contempt, particularly those toward those who stubbornly refuse to see the light. Middle America, in the view of this new class, he continued, quote, has come to symbolize everything that stands in the way of progress, and is expressed especially in the efforts, quote, and I quote again, to extend the range of personal choices in matters where people feel the most need of solid moral guideposts. What Lash described was a kind of conservative middle America in contrast to a new class living on its coasts that was increasingly disassociated from and living a kind of lives not guided by certain kinds of moral norms. And yet within a decade of Lash's analysis, what he describes here looks like a description of a different planet. The state of the working class in America by 2000, only 9 years after the publication of the book, The True and Only Heaven, that I'm quoting from. And then over the next two decades, as reported in the 2012 book Coming Apart by Charles Murray, by J.D. Vance in Hillbilly Elegy, and most recently in Tim Carney's excellent new book, Alienated America, reveals a portrait of a people on the brink of despair and dissolution. Social and economic dysfunction is the mark of this group of people who Lash described only 30 years ago as upholding the norms of traditional society. The abilities and practices needed to form families, to raise children with promising life prospects, to build flourishing households within stable communities of memory and tradition, to practice law-abidingness, to avoid temptations like drugs and alcohol, all of this has evaporated. And throughout the West today, comparable stories can be told. The British author David Goodhart describes the divide contributing to the populist uprising in England in his book, The Road to Somewhere, in which he contrasts the views of somewhere people with those of anywhere people. Those who value home, stability, generational continuity, tradition, memory, and those who consider themselves to have what Pico Iyer some years ago described as a global soul. Those with skills gained and honed at leading institutions that consist especially in the ability to live anywhere, anywhere where anywhere people congregate. According to Goodhart, and I quote, such people have portable achieved identities based on educational and career success, which makes them generally comfortable and confident with new places and people. In the view of anywhere people, the ruling class who makes decisions about the life prospects of somewhere people, those who remain somewhere, inundated especially now with rising social pathologies, in fact deserve their fate. For instance, according to the political scientist James Stimson, who's the Raymond Dawson Distinguished Bicentennial Professor of Political Science at the University of North Carolina, he stated, give a randomly selected group a choice to stay or to go, and those who choose to go will be profoundly different from those who stay. Those who are economically successful are ambitious and confident in their abilities. Those who are fearful, conservative in the social sense, and lack ambition stay and accept decline. In other words, the deteriorating conditions of the working class is their own fault. Such statements representative, if more frank than the explicit statements of many of today's elites, has constituted the conditions for the uprising of the people in recent elections around the world. What we have witnessed is the reassertion of that most ancient divide, the demarcation between the elite and the populace, the one in which, curiously, as I began by saying, it is the elite who claims the mantle of democracy and equality. Yet evident in the words of Stimson and his peers is the intention and ambition to eliminate the political relevance of somewhere people and a declared ambition to establish an effective despotism of anywhere people. In resisting this new manifestation of this very ancient form of tyranny, I submit that the ancient lessons must be learned anew, albeit in a new guise. And I want to suggest ways that they might be creatively brought up to date. While much of the discussion is today focused on efforts by a resurgent populist left to redistribute income, in the main, it seems to me, these proposals seem designed to leave intact the institutions and attitudes that divide the elite from the populace. What is needed, rather, in my view, is a focus upon a kind of redistribution of social capital, not one that costs the elites their social capital, but makes possible the greater advantages and indeed the possibility of better life prospects for those who are not so advantaged. But this must begin by a kind of self-awakened understanding that the egalitarianism and the egalitarian claims of today's elites in fact reflects a form of entrenched class self-interest and exists in some ways as an effort to retain exclusive possession of their relative social health that sustains their ascendant position. And by contrast, in effect, leaves their position unassailed by those who live at the margins. The current political energy of populism, it seems to me, should be directed at the creation of a mixed regime, breaking up the monopoly not only of economic power, but the social power that leads to the exclusive stability and health today that only wealth can provide, but which in earlier times would have been available to even those in straitened economic circumstances. My grandmother, who lived through the Depression, didn't have to live also through the kind of social dissolution that we're seeing today. What is needed, then, I want to suggest tonight, is the application of Machiavellian means to achieve Aristotelian ends. That is, an aggressive, confrontational, punitive, trust-busting political strategy aimed at taming the elites that in turn will result in a tutoring of the elite toward a concern for the common good and potentially a kind of mixed regime envisioned by the likes of Aristotle and Aquinas. Only through the tools of political resistance by the populace that were commended by Machiavelli, but one in which a general concern for the common good is the result, is and ought to be the aim, in which a genuine mixing of the classes might take place, and in which the elite might actually take on the features of aristoi, of excellence, virtue, magnanimity, and a concern for the common good. Now, I'm a political theorist, so I'm under no obligation or requirement, much less the ability, to provide any practical conclusions. And much like the conclusion of my book, I have nothing to say on that score. But in the spirit of thinking out loud, let me suggest some directions of thinking that we might take in thinking about the spirit of a mixed regime. And I offer these in the spirit of thinking out loud and not as a well-formulated program. But I trust that there are many people in this room far more knowledgeable about practical things than I am who can probably think about this much more intelligently and coherently. But for a few suggestions, we might turn to some of the lessons of the original populists, the so-called anti-federalists, the people who were suspicious of the concentration of power and wealth that they believed was the intent of the Constitution, and who feared that the Constitution's design would lead to the rule of an oligarchy concentrated in the nation's capital. What crazy, strange ideas they had. They insisted that the people should be given a stronger presence and voice in the national government, particularly seeking to ensure greater proximity between those who were representing and those represented. They called, for example, for small districts, not only in size, but also number, and as a result, potentially many members of the House. And James Madison, fearing that the Constitution would be scuttled by their demands, introduced an amendment along with those we count as the Bill of Rights that would limit the size of congressional districts to 50,000 people, in contrast to today's districts that number 750,000 people. This congressional apportionment amendment was passed in the first Congress and actually ratified by 11 states, meaning we only need 27 more. And if it's successful, we will have a House of Representatives of 6,000 members. Now, while we might regard such so massive a House as not very effective, unlike today's House, it seems to me that even the threat of passage of this amendment, if some states were to begin the process of passing this extant and already passed, already congressionally approved amendment, would motivate our current Congress to do what you can simply do by a simple act of legislation, which is increase the size of the House, increase the numbers of people in the House. And at least some of the studies that have been done have been shown if you increase the number of the House to about 1,000, it wouldn't change the electoral division of the country. It would just increase the number of representatives and therefore the likelihood that those who would be representing will be drawn, as the Anti-Federalists hoped, from the body of the people. One of the Anti-Federalists wrote that he hoped the House would not become the stronghold of speculative men, an older term for anywhere people, hoping instead for a House comprised of people, to quote an Anti-Federalist, of middling circumstance. Sounds like Aristotle. Animated by a desire to protect common concerns necessary for the flourishing of local life. In the same spirit, we might look back to a more modern or more recent form of progressivism, those populists of the 19th century. And one proposal I've always kind of liked was proposed by William Jennings Bryan and his allies in Congress, who created the Federal Reserve, but insisted and failed that some of its voting members must include a farmer, a wage earner, a small businessman, and other people from other walks of life, concerned that a Fed comprised entirely of bankers might actually favor financiers. A proposal such as this, one in which various professions, or what would have once been called estates, might be included and represented, could be in some ways instantiated throughout the federal bureaucracy, rather than just looking at people from Harvard and Yale and Princeton. And be done through the presidential appointment process, and in the case of the Fed, through a piece of legislation. A further and even more radical way of mixing, one that will be very popular in this room, especially to its property owners, is to break up Washington, D.C. itself. As Ross Douthat has written on this score, I quote Ross, "We should treat liberal cities like liberals want to treat corporate monopolies, not as growth-enhancing assets, but as trusts that concentrate wealth and power and conspire against the public good. Instead of trying to make them a little more egalitarian with looser zoning rules and more affordable housing, we should make like Teddy Roosevelt and break it up." It is, to my mind, coming from South Bend, obscene that the nation's capital has become the national epicenter of such extreme wealth and the largest concentration of what Charles Murray describes as super zips, those areas that combine those with elite education and wealth. If there was good reason to have this geographic concentration of the federal government, its departments and agencies at the time of the expansion of the federal government, I mean, there were women, you know, connecting phone lines as dispatchers. Today, with the advent of the internet and video conferencing, it seems that it's only the continuing self-interest of a wealthy and powerful bipartisan elite that perpetuates itself in part by concentrating itself in this one city. A mixed government should not only seek ways to mix the elements of government, but the people themselves. In this spirit, I think the nation should also revisit the question of national service. An earlier generation regarded military service as a requirement for good citizenship, but the last president who at least uncontestedly served, indeed who enlisted before he was of age, passed away late last year. Our infantry today is composed increasingly today of people from parts of the country that are never encountered by those living in super zips. Indeed, fewer Americans today personally know anyone serving or who has served in the military than at any time in American history. Now, it may be, as our generals would quickly tell us, that there is no need or demand for a large conscript army. But it would be a matter of political will to insist that it is in the civic interest of America that more Americans engage in military service, not simply those who have no other or better choice. And recalling to mind the ancient arguments that a standing army is always a threat against the self-government of a republic. Among other things, an army composed of the children of the upper classes is less likely to be deployed to dangerous places where we perhaps ought not to be. But recognizing that we don't need an army composed of every young person between the ages of 18 and 20, differential forms of service could be instituted, especially given the great need for a civilian army to address the disrepair of our infrastructure and even greater need to repair our civic culture, especially through the mingling of people from a variety of ways and walks of life. Indeed, one of the great achievements of American equality was achieved by this intermingling of people from different classes through their service in the military. Such forms of mixing should become a major priority in rethinking the role and status of elite universities in America today, and I come to you from one of them. These institutions have become very well-tuned sifting machines, separating economic wheat from chaff, perpetuating a class divide that they purport to condemn. Already some of the nation's most elite institutions, including mine, have been dinged with taxation to their endowments, but this is a blunt instrument that does not actually alter their behavior. President Trump's recent announcement that he will or plans to withhold federal funding from institutions that do not ensure free speech is a kind of model, but it too is a blunt instrument that leaves intact the structures of the meritocracy. Instead, both taxes to endowment and threats to federal funding should be used as inducements to these wealthy institutions to pursue genuine socioeconomic diversity in order to achieve that purported diversity of their student body that they always claim to seek, as well as incentivizing the creation of satellite campuses in less prosperous locations. And there might be many ways in which you could seek to mix these institutions both on campus and beyond campus. Also deserving of exploration are ways of forgiving either federal debt or incentivizing institutions to pay the full freight for students who pursue careers outside of the typical areas of finance, consulting, working in high-powered law firms, but instead might actually prefer to pursue careers as teachers, soldiers, ministers, potentially small-town lawyers or doctors. Today, these institutions are using both direct federal funds and indirect state and federal tax advantages to perpetuate an oligarchy, while shrouding themselves in the claims of woke equality. They should be compelled into participation in a new regime of mixed regime if they won't do it themselves. Similar efforts should be undertaken to break up or limit the power of monopolistic economic organizations, with special attention focused on those concerns that are making the empowerment and solidifying the position of anywhere people a main part of their political activities. The recent interference of corporations in the form of the threat of economic devastation in the democratic processes in states such as Indiana, Arizona, Arkansas, and North Carolina should not be brooked. Any economic institution with sufficient power to bring economic ruin upon a state should be severely curtailed in the name of the common good. The left used to believe this, but they went silent when corporations like Apple were bullying my home state of Indiana. This focus should be true of those semi-private institutions like the NCAA, who use their privileged position and their tax advantage status to circumvent the will of somewhere people. Political leaders whose position is owed to such people should dispel any nostalgic views about the free market and free enterprise, instead recognizing that such economic institutions are seeking to shape a social order that is amenable to the oligarchic class. A Machiavellian assertion of popular tumult should be directed at either preventing such abuses of financial power or seeking to dismantle such institutions. Renewed efforts at a moral media should be pursued. Here, Charles Murray's observations that elites do not preach what they practice should be emphasized. Programming that lionizes various forms of transgression and libertinism, sexual license, positive portrayal of drug usage, profanity that becomes second nature, the mockery of religious belief should be denounced as perpetuating the class advantage of the elite, a form of propaganda that seeks to suppress the life prospects of the lower working class, for whom these transgressions is not the safe play of sophomores, but the difference between life and death. Those with a megaphone shouldn't play the parts merely of scolds, emphasizing its immorality, but rather denounce its elitism, its deployment as an effort to destroy the lives of the less fortunate. Debates over immigration should be reframed as yet another way that the elite class perpetuates its position, suppressing the income of working classes while ensuring the elite has an affordable working class. Rather than attacking immigrants, however, which is too often cast in racist tones, effort should be directed at those who employ illegal immigrants, a tactic not unlike that of the pro-life movement that focuses not on the despair of pregnant women, but on the greed of those who would profit from their misfortune. High-profile arrests and prosecutions of employers who break existing laws should become regular features of national reporting. I'm sure CNN will be all over that one. And should act as a powerful deterrent, which should have an effect perhaps greater in its impact than a wall is likely to achieve. And it should also be called to mind that such efforts to restrict illegal immigration in the effort to support the working class was the position of renowned civil rights leaders, including Notre Dame's Father Theodore Hesburgh. This should be often recalled. Other efforts at mixing should be considered. Changing our electoral process to favor caucuses over primaries would shift power from elite opinion makers and those who can afford money for advertising, instead to the living rooms of citizens. Government policy favoring consolidation of farms and subsidizing urbanization and suburbanization of American life should be reversed. Following Tim Carney's book, one of the best ways to redistribute social capital is through strengthening the institutions of civil society. There is a need to be more frank about the role played by the combined concentrated political and economic power that has had a destructive effect on the social institutions whose benefits, particularly flourishing family and community life, ought to be more equally available to every citizen in our nation. To conclude then, the task of a renewed political movement arising from the divide both in our nation and across the globe ought in the first instance to direct real threats to the continued advantages and position enjoyed by our society's elites. But the deeper aim ought not to be the fanciful destruction of all forms of inequality that has been a stated belief, if never an actual practice, of a main part of the political left. For as we know from history, elites never disappear, and those who replace the elites in the name of extinguishing all distinction simply become the new elites, yet are often harsher and more cruel. Rather, by using Machiavellian means to Aristotelian ends, efforts at genuine forms of mixing should be undertaken with the aim that today's elite, for the lack of a better word, the oligarchs, instead be forced to become, to use a different word, genuine aristocrats. Not aristocrats in that negative meaning of the word, simply describing someone of an unearned superior position, but in the classical sense, someone of virtue, excellence, and above all, someone who regards that status that they have as a kind of gift and entailing obligations to be put in the service of those less advantaged. Today, with the elite adopting the banner of democracy and equality as a cover for further advancement of status and power, it is safe to conclude that the ennobling of our elite will not come from the voluntary showering of goodwill and generosity, but rather through the force of a direct threat from the populi. In days yet to come, it might be hoped that through a kind of Aristotelian habituation in virtue, a genuine aristoi might arise, yet ironically through the efforts of an angered and demanding populace. But in turn, we might yet hope that such an aristoi will work to improve the lives, prospects, and fate of these people, making in turn the kind of people who themselves take on the qualities of genuine aristoi, the elevation that equality can aspire to. Through a genuine mixing of excellences possible to a noble nobility and the decent hopes of a people demanding better from those with advantages, might we actually come to witness a kind of regime change that we need, the flowering of a mixed regime, a kind of aristopopulism, aristocratic and Aristotelian, that might come again to deserve the name Republic. Thank you.
For two or three questions, I will choose the questioner and Patrick will answer.
Maybe.
Yes, right there. You with the blue shirt on.
Thank you so much for this talk.
Can you introduce yourself?
Zach.
Zach. See, part of the problem is we don't have last names anymore.
I'm Zach Talley. I'm sure you know as the Talley plant.
Good. Thank you.
Somewhere.
But when you discuss the idea that basically you can't subvert reality, there will always be this lie between the elites and the populace, and this need for the elites to come back and to react to popular scene. I remember this perversion of it that you see in this phenomenon, especially on college campuses, these kids of the elites that are woke and that will talk about things like the importance of giving up their privilege as though they can't. They know that they can't because of this identity politics. And so they do things like talk about the importance of the common man and then buy $80,000 BMWs that are 100% renewable energy because that's how you help out the common man. So it seems to me that they're trying to do something similar to what you're saying, but there's complete perversion that exists there. Would you agree? And then where does this perversion come from? Is it just a misdefinition of what the good is?
Yeah. So I actually have an article in First Things about this phenomenon, actually several articles, but one is called The Ignoble Lie. And one of the things that struck me over the years is that the students that I teach, and I've taught at Princeton, Georgetown, and Notre Dame, I mean, some really remarkable, extraordinary institutions, when students read Plato's Republic and they read about the noble lie, they get really upset about the part of the lie in which Plato describes, Socrates describes, that some people love gold in their soul and some people silver and some people bronze. They don't like that inequality part of it. Whereas when Plato described this myth, I think what he intended was that the elites would get upset at the notion that everyone was born of a common mother, which is the other part of the noble lie. So in a certain way, as I described it in the article in First Things, I think what we're seeing is a kind of self-deception that's taking place. And I'm not suggesting that it's intentional in some way. I think it's very much a kind of almost a form of self-protection. And it does take the effect of having a form of status self-protection, in which it's precisely in a kind of democratic age, it's the claim of having a greater commitment to equality that makes you immune from the very fact that you are, in fact, constitute a kind of oligarchy or a kind of elite. It obscures that fact of your status from yourself. And so one of the things that, oddly enough, I try to do in many of my classes is to expose this fact to my students by making various proposals like, how many of you would support eliminating the idea of an admissions office and populating our universities by lot, right? Which is what Aristotle describes as a genuinely democratic commitment, right? It's aristocratic to have elections. If you really want to be a democracy, you have selection by lot. And my students get really upset at this idea. They don't like this very much because they have earned and deserved their position in these various institutions. So in some ways, I think part of what needs to be done is to the extent possible, and if there are people in these institutions willing to do so, is to expose this kind of self-deception, bring it to the surface. But it seems to me, and here the argument of tonight, is that I don't think that's ultimately going to be enough, because there's reasons why that self-deception is obviously so powerfully articulated on today's campuses, which is precisely it is the form of the oligarchy protecting its status and position. Which again, classical philosophers would tell you, this is what oligarchs would do. And the only thing that's likely to correct that is a kind of pushback that we're now seeing from the commoners, from the common people. The irony being that it's precisely this pushback that's being denounced as inegalitarian, as elitist, as fundamentally unwoke. So I do think that we're in this rather unique position, but the old description and the classical understanding of this phenomenon seems to me to hold great explanatory force and real potential for how to think our way through what we're currently experiencing.
Yes, right there on the other side. Yeah, part of the fellow in the back with the tie on. I like that.
Very aristocratic.
I'm Nick Burns.
Is that mic on?
Vice versa, to sort of each benefit while the people are the ones who lose. this is the modern world that we live in. I think we don't have a mass and an elite in the same way. And there have been attempts to sort of recreate two classes, which seems to be a better situation, this kind of agonistic politics. Marx, I think, in a way, was trying to do this, but it didn't work. He couldn't create these classes if he wanted to. So I guess how does your proposal aim to sort of change the situation where either we don't have two classes that can, you know, create this aristocratism, or people don't want to believe that there are?
Yeah. Well, you know, in some ways, the least brief mention of the 1950s through as part of the latter part of the 20th century was, I think, accords with exactly this description of what, you know, broadly speaking, what we thought of as America. And for many of us of a certain age, that's the ideal, right? That's in many ways what we just simply would like to recreate. And what I'm suggesting now is that we're looking increasingly like the description of Rome that Machiavelli offers in the Discourses of, you know, these two groups. And of course there's this other, right, much smaller portion of the, we could say broadly, the electorate that they're both in some ways trying to fight over, and it could go either way. But I think it's fair to say that we are in the current moment experiencing something much closer to that description of the elite and mass that Machiavelli describes. What worries me about the, put it this way, the Machiavellian description is Machiavelli's argument is not simply that you need this great contestation between these classes, but that Roman liberty then becomes the fuel for the project of national greatness and expansion. And so what Machiavelli's solution is really designed to provoke is a kind of commitment that in many ways is part of why the consensus of the 1950s fell apart. Right? In the first instance, the expansion of the American empire and the expansion of the global economic organization of our world. And so it was the very kind of Machiavellian solution of how you orient a polity that was at least partly adopted by America, oddly enough. Not the clashing part, which in the 1950s wasn't necessarily the case, but the belief that it was through a kind of national status and power and the expansion of American power that this would be achieved. And one of the reasons we see a growing divide today is a growing divide between how we're experiencing that empire, that far-flung empire, who's serving, right, and who's clapping for them at nationals games, right, who's doing the self-sacrifice, and who's living on sort of cheap patriotism, right? But as well as, of course, the effects of globalization. And I think the argument for Machiavellian means to Aristotelian ends in part makes an argument that a genuine common good is going to consider, right, the common good of everyone, and not simply the good that will end up redounding to the benefit of the oligarchs in the name of purported equality.
One more question. In the very back, the hand high.
Oh, very tall.
Tall fellow, yeah.
Oh, not the tall fellow.
There's a recent essay by Adrian Vermeule in American
Affairs. Yeah, I always get a Vermeule question.
Are you an iterationist? Have you ever been an iterationist?
Sorry. So he argues that...
He's already tweeting about this as we speak.
And his description of invisible hand accounts strikes me as very similar, actually, to your description of Machiavellian accounts, mm-hmm. whereby sort of clashing, opposing forces without necessarily any intention come together to somehow miraculously produce the good. And of course, Vermeule's whole argument is that these are all fantasies and the evidence that these actually work is scant. So I guess my question is sort of two parts. Does your formulation, Machiavellian ends for Aristotelian means, classify as an invisible hand account? If so, is that a problem? And if not, does that suggest
No, in fact, I think mine is not an invisible hand. It's a very visible hand, and it's kind of the back of the hand. I think Adrian will be very excited about my talk tonight because he will conclude that I have finally come around, that we need Schmittian, Machiavellian assertion of power. to assert the will of those who should be the good guys. In many ways, it is directly against the idea that the invisible hand will sort out all of these problems. And I think one of the wonderful things about Adrian's account is not only are invisible hand accounts ultimately sort of incoherent, as I think he powerfully lays out in that essay, but ultimately, uncoincidentally, tend to redound to the advantage of the oligarchic class. Or put it this way, they produce a certain kind of an oligarchic class. So it ends up, even the invisible hand smuggles in something that we might not see, but it's still a hand that's doing some pretty powerful manipulating. So my argument tonight is really a kind of reassertion of politics. A reassertion of politics, but not, and these concluding proposals, they all might be zany and crazy, and it was really offered in the spirit of, we really have to think in some different ways, like breaking up Washington, D.C. Well, why don't we put some of these agencies where probably most of you end up work, and and we got a lot of really nice, beautiful buildings in South Bend that have a lot of space in them. They're really being underutilized. We got old Studebaker plants. We could fix those things up, and all those people working in the Department of Homeland Security, come on out to South Bend. Beautiful winters, lots of skiing. We have a good women's basketball team, and there's lots of amenities you could have. But it seems to me that there are things we could do in a very visible way to begin to seek a kind of mixing of what has become a highly geographically sorted country, and not merely geographically sorted, but of course sorted into people with very different life experiences and life prospects. And I think if this could be done in various creative ways, it might save us from what I think is the other option, which, as I suggested in the talk, either the prospect of tyranny or the prospect of anarchy, and perhaps those two things together. So I genuinely think that from these very ancient thinkers, conceived of and thought through in new and creative ways, there might be the possibility of something, of some